I'm HRN's Executive Director, Katie Mosman-Wadler, with a preview of this week's episode of Meat and Three, our weekly food news roundup. Last month, Hurricane Florence walloped parts of North Carolina. According to the Weather Channel, it was the wettest tropical storm to ever hit the Tar Heel State. So how did the restaurant industry respond? Some helped FEMA weather the storm, while others got to work feeding people on the ground.
We just walked in and said, we know how to cook, what can we do? They said, I need you guys to just cook 150 pork loins. And we were just like, okay.
Now the attention needs to be on Florence's long-term effect on North Carolina's farming community.
The general mood of farmers is one of certainly resilience and almost feels like it's the normal course of business to just get hit by a gigantic hurricane and need to just keep on going.
So tune in to this week's Meat and Three on Heritage Radio Network, available wherever you listen to podcasts.
Today's program is brought to you by 100 Bogart Street, a co-working and event space in Bushwick, Brooklyn. Learn more at 100bogart.com.
Hello, and welcome to A Hungry Society. I'm Korsha Wilson, and this is the show where we talk about food, food media, and so much more. Today's guest is Naz Riahi, the founder and creative director of Bitten, an experiential series that positions food as a pillar of pop culture and explores the space through the lens of creativity, innovation, technology, art, trends, and fun. Naz is a veteran of the advertising industry and continues to work with startup and corporate clients on creative communications and brand strategy. She's worked with Hilton Worldwide, Dig In, Pepsi, and dozens of other brands. Naz lives in Brooklyn with her dog, her very adorable dog, Hugo. She also has an MFA in creative writing and makes short films. Naz, welcome to A Hungry Society.
Hi, Korsha. Thank you for having me.
I'm so excited to have you here today. Bitten is such a cool event. Well, why don't you talk a little bit about Bitten and your events that you host?
Okay, well, I feel like you're bearing the lead here because you're one of our speakers this year.
I am. I didn't want to start with that.
I can't not start with that because I'm legitimately so excited to have you. So Bitten is mostly known for an annual conference that we host. I hate calling it a conference because that comes with certain connotations of just gross networking and selling yourself, and that's not at all what Bitten is about. I kind of like to think about it as an ideas and inspiration event. It was created to get people to leave their desk, leave their computer, stop whatever they do on a daily basis for a half a day, almost a full day, and think about something different. And of course, food relates to every single person in some capacity. So it was designed not just for people who work in the food space, which to me seemed very insular, and it was designed specifically to engage an audience that was a little bit more broad and worked in different industries from definitely hospitality, CPG, food, but also we have people who work at banks that come. We have people who work in advertising, people who are designers, a lot of independent creatives who are kind of figuring out their future and their work and their passion come for the inspiration. And it's a one-day event, the main stage event, although we do host salons occasionally. And it's from about 8:30 to 3:30 in the afternoon. And we have a series of keynote addresses similar to TED Talks with an amazing slew of speakers. And I work with every single speaker on their talk. So it's I spend basically the whole year curating the event, which sounds crazy, but is also incredibly, incredibly fun.
Yeah, so one of the things I love about Bitten and why I said yes to being a part of it is that it is, like you said, like you addressed, like so many food events can be so insular and like insider baseball. You're kind of talking to people who work in the industry, like you know all the people in the audience, and I've heard you say before that you love when speakers are like, I don't know anybody here. Mm-hmm. Like that's the point of Bitten, is to like, it's about creativity and art and technology and fun and trends. Yeah. With the lens of food, but that mm-hmm. applies to anyone and everybody. You don't have to be in the industry.
Totally. And we talk about all sorts of things. One of the things that I think is really, really important is when we talk about food, there is a huge amount of possibility to get negative because there are a lot of sort of serious crises happening in the food space, which are important, and it's important for us to talk about it. But food also is a huge sort of vehicle for inspiration. And regardless of the talk, I want there to be an actionable, positive sort of spin to it. Not actually, that's a really bad way of putting it. Not a spin, but I want the audience to feel empowered. I don't want them to leave feeling like, oh, fuck, we're screwed. Oh, sorry, I'm not supposed to swear on this.
You can swear as much as you want on the show. I encourage it.
I'm like a sailor. So for example, we've had talks on cultural appropriation. What is that in food? It's obviously something really important and something that confuses people a lot, and people get very defensive about it. And I felt like it was really important to talk about it. We have talks about design in the same token, and like how design can save the world when it comes to food. We have talks this year. We have Emily Baltz giving a talk about the intersection of art and food and how artists have used food as a medium. Which I'm so excited about. You are giving a talk about the future restaurant and all the possibilities that mm-hmm. exist within the restaurant space. Mm-hmm. And I won't give too much away, but it's a little bit unexpected and exciting. So it really runs the gamut. We have this year, Sophia Hampton is opening. She's our youngest speaker. She's 21. Our oldest speaker is in her 60s. So we have speakers in every age group from 20s to 60s, which is super exciting. And she's going to talk about why farming and a holistic food system are really important to her. And she's a Gen Zer. So a lot of our audience are a lot older than her. And I think it's really important for them to hear her perspective and why she's interested in food and why a lot of her friends and fellow students at NYU are interested in food, because that's going to sort of set us up for the future of food. And then right after that, we have Amma Kapai, who is the founder or a partner, excuse me, at a strategy shop called Wolf and Willemien, and they're experts in the Gen Z space. She's going to come and actually give a talk about who Gen Zers are and how they're influencing the food space. Mm. So,
yeah, the lineup is amazing.
Thank you.
I don't know if you want to talk about a couple more speakers. But.
I want to talk about all of them. Right. I love them all so much. Oh, you and I were just talking about our friend Lori Willever,
yes.
who was Anthony Bourdain's longtime collaborator, assistant. She considers him her mentor, her friend, her boss, and she's coming to give a talk about Tony. Mm-hmm. It's called On Tony, or How Everybody Wants a Hero. Mm-hmm. And I'm just so grateful to her for sharing that story. This is the first place where she's going to be giving a talk like that about him. And I think the audience is going to be blown away.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Lori, shout out to her. She co-hosts a podcast called Carb Face Pod, mm-hmm. which if you're listening to this, you should definitely check that out too. It's like a more irreverent take on the food world and news out of the food world. And Lori is brilliant. So I kind of talked about it in the intro, but you came to start Bitten after a career in advertising. Can you talk about how Bitten came about and like why you wanted to start it?
Yeah, absolutely. So I had spent my whole career working at big corporations, doing all sorts of things, kind of always in the advertising, marketing, brand, trend space. And I worked at a really interesting job doing innovation sort of strategy and creative direction at a huge agency. And that was an incredible experience because I learned so much, but it was also a brutal, heartbreaking experience and didn't end well. I was an outspoken woman of color, the only woman of color in my group who demanded to get paid the same as the guys. And that wasn't happening. And so after that, I really was just broken. It broke me. And I couldn't imagine going and getting another job and working in that environment again. So I knew I had to do my own thing. And in this funny way, when I came up with the idea of Bitten, it's kind of ironic because I didn't think of it this way when I came up with the idea, but it nourished me back. It kind of brought me back to life, the way food can actually physically do working in the space and coming up with these ideas and meeting all of these incredible people gave me my vitality back and made me excited to work again.
Mm. Yeah, as I was doing research about you before our interview, like we have some like similarities in common. I also was fired at like a pivotal point in my career. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I was one of two women of color working at a restaurant. You know, I was asked to be a manager, but there was no sort of management training. Mm-hmm. It was just kind of like, you're either going to do well or you're not.
Yeah.
And I did not. I was like 22.
Oh, you were so young. Yeah,
I was a baby. I was, you know, attempting to manage people who had been working in restaurants for like my entire life.
Mm-hmm.
And that kind of, you know, set the course of what I do now. It was kind of like, okay, well, I've always wanted to be a food writer. I should actually attempt to be a food writer.
Oh, it's amazing how something horrible can kind of force you to do the thing that you actually want to do. And you know, props to you. Being a food writer is also not easy. Making a living as a writer is not easy. Mm-hmm. You and I also share, did you know this? In that I have a bachelor's in journalism too. And I have an MFA in creative writing. So we're both also writers.
Yes, we're both writers.
So I know how hard that is. And you're an incredible writer. That's really why I reached out to you. I started, after Lori recommended you, I started reading your pieces and was really blown away by the eloquence and the force and the intelligence and the research and everything behind them.
Oh, thank you so much. So another thing we have in common is a favorite movie.
Oh, which one?
It is the James Baldwin documentary, I Am Not Your Negro.
Yes.
Is one of my favorite movies ever.
It's the movie I say everyone has to watch. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Can you talk about that for listeners who haven't seen it before?
Oh, yeah. I've forgotten the director's name. Do you remember the filmmaker's name?
No.
Ugh, aren't we terrible? I should know this. So basically, I know everything about him. I know he went to film school in Berlin. I know. So it came out a couple of years ago, and it's a sort of a documentary in an interesting sense of the word, in that it's not a talking heads documentary. It's a lot of old footage that was taken from interviews with James Baldwin and people of that era. And I actually ended up reading Jessica Harris's book, which includes a lot about him, because I was so excited after that. And of course, I love reading James Baldwin. But I don't want to give too much away. It's incredibly powerful and will make you think about the world, see the world in a way maybe you've suspected the world is, but weren't ready to admit or couldn't put your finger on.
Yeah, that movie, speaking of pivotal moments, like for me, when that came out and I saw it, it kind of solidified what I wanted to do as a food writer, which is be a witness to all the cool things that people are doing and not getting attention for.
Yeah.
And it the movie is powerful enough to do that. Like it kind of, it's taking place in the past, obviously, mm-hmm. but a lot of the messages still resonate. And no matter who you are, you can take something from it.
Absolutely. And it's a lot of James Baldwin's writing is the narration of the film.
Raoul Peck.
Yeah, Raoul Peck. Absolutely.
Yeah, that's his name.
Yeah.
So I have a question for you.
Oh,
if you had to give your own talk at Bitten, what would it be about?
Literally so many things. One talk that I really want to give is a talk about all the cool people doing cool works in the food space who I couldn't have come to Bitten and present for one reason or another. Bitten is so much about discovery. I don't have celebrities on Bitten. I just don't want the same story told over and over again. I want people to discover new things. And that would be, I think, a really interesting talk. I've given a talk about what it means to say that food is a pillar of pop culture before. Mm. And that's definitely an interesting one because it traces sort of the trajectory of how food became this all-encompassing thing that all of these other sort of pillars of pop culture are also intersected with. And then I think one of the other talks I would give is sort of about how food helped me assimilate to this country. I actually recently wrote an essay. I wrote a book recently that I've been writing for a couple of years that I'm almost done with the third draft. And I just sold the first essay from the book.
Oh, congratulations.
Thank you. And it's called Eating to America, and it's about that. It's about how I immigrated here as a 9-year-old and then assimilated to the culture and the country through food, and it tells some of those really pivotal stories. And so it's coming out in long reads, which is the website, and long form is the podcast, the day before Thanksgiving. But I think that is... I wrote that and then I sent it to a few people to read and was really shocked by the fact that even my American friends could relate to it and it resonated with them in a way that I hadn't expected. I thought only really immigrants could understand it.
Mm. Wow. So I'm fascinated by that talk of, you know, food as a pillar of pop culture. What are some of the key moments that kind of solidify food as in the pop culture realm?
Well, when I was doing the research for the talk, by the way, I'm really trying to coin that term. No one's using it yet, but I've been saying it since I created Bitten. When I was doing the research for it, one really interesting thing that I found out, and I really should know who this is and remember the text, but the term food porn was first used in a 1980s feminist textbook, which was fascinating to me. I want to get my hands on it and read it. But definitely, I think that food media played a huge role in that, starting with magazines and sort of the transformation of magazines from just being a place where you go and read recipes and learn how to cook new things to them covering personalities in the food space. And then obviously the beginning of the reality sort of before. There was, again, like there were the people like the Julia Childs who were incredibly important in ushering this movement along because they were food personalities. But those stories were not about them. The shows weren't about them personally, even though they were big personalities in those shows. They were about the food and the recipes. And then sort of how that changed with the intersection of reality TV and cooking shows. And then, of course, people like Anthony Bourdain. I think media played the biggest role in creating our experience of food today.
Mm, absolutely. How do you approach curating the list of people forbidden?
So I spend a lot of time reading all sorts of things, not just food publications, but I'm a big reader of all sorts of books. And that's sort of a big way that seeds for ideas are planted in my head. Excuse me, I'm not being articulate. So I spend a great deal of the year reading and talking to people, going out to coffee with people. I talk to my former speakers. I talk to my current speakers. I ask them for recommendations. And it's sort of, there are certain things that I do and there are certain things I absolutely won't do. And that begins to help me shape the speakers and the talks. So one of the things that is really important to me, as I mentioned, is I want to introduce people to my audience to new people. So I hardly ever go after a celebrity. Anthony Bourdain was actually the one person I really wanted, celebrity I really wanted to speak at Bitten for obvious reasons. I also think it's really incredibly important to make sure that my speakers are at least half women and half people of color, because I have missed out on so many opportunities because I was both of those things. And now that I have a stage and a microphone, it's 100% my responsibility to foster that community and help bring them up. Because if we don't support each other, then we're screwed. Right. So that's important to me. This year, it's not always easy to accomplish that, but I absolutely do my best to do that. And so this year, actually, all of the speakers except for one are women. Tunde Wei is our only male speaker. And I'm really excited about that. And it's been interesting to see people's reaction because it seems so novel. Whereas if a conference, up until very recently, if a conference had only white men speaking, it was never novel or anything anyone would even notice.
Right.
So this wasn't done as a marketing sort of scheme for me. I don't use feminism or inclusivity for marketing purposes. It just happened to be that these were the stories I wanted to tell this time and the people I wanted to hear from. So a few things that I don't do is I no longer work with speakers who put me in touch with their publicists or their agents. Some of my best friends are publicists. I know some really wonderful agents. I know that they work really hard for their clients, but this is a one-woman operation and I don't have the capacity to jump through hoops and go through intermediaries. So if I can't text my speaker, if I can't get on a call with them easily, it's not a good fit. I've had someone say to me when I asked them to speak, someone on their team wrote back and said, do you have hair and makeup? And I was like, oh, this is not that kind of conference. And, you know, no offense taken. And I hope that they weren't offended by that. It's just that's just not who we are. Mm-hmm. I also do not take speaker pitches. I used to, and it has never worked out. And it's the weirdest thing. So I no longer do it. And I have publicists message me all the time, and also people at companies asking for their CEOs to speak. And the greatest irony in that is that these are big companies and they refuse to sponsor Bitten. They refuse to give us any money to support it. They don't even buy tickets to come, but they want to speak. And mm-hmm. year after year, this year, there's one yogurt company who messages me all the time, and I actually love their product and I wish that they would sponsor Bitten. But every year they message me and they say, can our founder speak? Can we have product at your event? And I'm like, yes, you can totally sponsor Bitten and support us. And they won't do it.
Like, actually, we just wanted to send some yogurt. So,
yeah, no, everybody wants to advertise for free. Everyone wants their speaker, their founder to speak. And I don't usually mix sponsors and speakers because I don't want this to feel like it's, this is what gives it its sort of true depth and why it's so exciting, because it's not, nobody's up there advertising anything. Mm-hmm. And I think that that's really important. So there's a big separation of church and state, as they say, for me there. So, and I also now respond to people who want to give me in-kind product. And I say, in-kind is not kind.
You should also trademark that.
It's someone else's. Someone said this to me and I totally co-opted it because it's not like it costs money to put this event on.
Mm-hmm. That's awesome. All right. So we're going to take a quick break. We'll be right back with Naz Riahi of Bitten.
Bogart has made much progress over the past year since their grand opening. They are a growing community of professional freelancers, entrepreneurs, and startups. Their dedicated team guarantees you receive a productive and worry-free work environment. 100 Bogart is currently filling up their 2-person to 12-person private offices. The spacious pop-up gallery, premier rooftop, and brand new full floor with terrace are available for your next event. Podcast rooms, conference rooms, and meeting spaces are also available for booking. 100 Bogart hosts events like art exhibitions, pop-up stores, product launches, and fashion shows. Heritage Radio Network is a proud member of the 100 Bogart community and often holds events in the building. Visit 100bogart.com to schedule a tour and learn more. When I'm still blind.
All right, so we are back with Naz Riahi of Bitten, and we have some exciting news to share. I'm going to let Naz do the honors.
Oh, this is very exciting. So when Korsha and I were first speaking about her coming to Bitten, she suggested that we do a ticket giveaway to two of her listeners who maybe can't afford to pay full price for the tickets, which we're really, really, really excited about. I know that a lot of especially young women come to both of us for mentoring, although this is a contest that's open to anybody. But it's important to us to support the next generation.
Yes. So I'm follow my Instagram. It is A Hungry Society on Twitter and Instagram. And I'm going to have details of how you email me and what you say if you'd like a ticket. It's just going to be a quick, simple prompt. And I can't wait to meet two of you at the conference. There's going to be some amazing talks.
Amazing.
And it's going to be a great, great day. So.
Oh, and people can go to the Bitten website or our Instagram. Everything is at This Is Bitten to see the agenda.
Excellent.
Yeah.
So you moved here to America when you were 9 years old, correct?
Yes. Good memory.
Yeah.
And also you pronounced my name correctly, which I'm very impressed by.
Thank you. You know what's funny is that every episode I like second guess myself and always screw somebody's name up. But
well, not yet. There's still time.
Right. There's still time for me to mess this up. So can you talk about coming to America? And you have a really interesting story about how you even found out that you were going to be moving. if you want to, about watching Cinderella.
You totally took me by surprise. No, my mom and I moved to the States. Actually, it was a very tragic story. My dad was killed in Iran by the Iranian government. And my mom and I moved here mostly because she didn't want me to grow up in the shadow of that tragedy in a country where a lot of people knew what had happened. And so we packed up and left, and it was one of the hardest things I've ever done in my life, and it followed one of the hardest years of my life. I've actually, as I've been writing the book, I've been thinking back about that year, and it's incredible how much of it I've blocked out. I actually completely don't remember most of an entire year of my life. It's shocking.
Wow.
So we moved here. My mom spoke a little bit of English. She had lived here with my dad in the late 60s, I think, or early 70s. And my brother was already here going to college. And so, and I didn't speak a word of English. I came here and everybody just kept saying, oh, you'll learn. And I was like, how am I just going to one day learn? And it kind of did actually happen that way. I went to fourth grade and I knew how to say three things, hello and no English. And by the end of fourth grade, I could speak fluently, which is, it still seems like magic to me.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's incredible.
Yeah.
And where did you go to fourth grade? Like, where in the country?
So for some reason, my mom decided to move us to a suburb of Seattle, which does not have a large Iranian community or population. I didn't grow up with many other Iranian kids, but one of her best friends and her husband and her children had moved from our suburb of Tehran to this suburb of Seattle. It's called Bellevue. It's a city. It's kind of a big city now. Everybody knows it. Mm-hmm. But they lived in Iran. They lived six houses away from us. In Bellevue, they lived six streets away from us. My mom's friend's husband worked at Boeing. Her friend was a doctor. And I think she felt like that was a good grounding for us and good people to be around, which was a great decision, I think, on her part. The unfortunate thing was that I didn't grow up with a lot of other Middle Eastern kids around me, not a lot of Iranians or Middle Easterners. So it wasn't easy. Fourth grade especially was incredibly hard because I was brown and I was from Iran and nobody really knew where that was. And their parents didn't talk about it, and everybody pronounced, if they knew, they pronounced it Iran, which a lot of people still do. And then there was this girl who was Japanese who was in my class who had moved from Tokyo, and she was so cool, and she had like the best magazines, and everybody loved her, and everybody hated me.
You're like, wait, I'm also from another place.
I was like, you guys don't want any cuckoo sabzi? Like, she was bringing cool Japanese candy.
That I really hope that's in your book because that's amazing.
Yeah, and then like there was a boy who was from Japan also, and he played sports really well, so everybody like super liked him, and I just had really frizzy hair with bangs and ate weird food and yeah, got locked in closets a lot in fourth grade.
Oh my god,
yeah, it was awesome.
So I'm curious, like, what did your mom cook a lot when you moved to Washington? Or
yeah, so what's really funny is growing up in Iran, because of obviously colonialism, everybody aspires to be European, and especially at that time. And then my mom had traveled all around the world with my dad. My dad went to the Naval Academy in Cambridge, and so he spoke English fluently. He spoke Italian. He spoke a little bit of French. They had lived in the States together. So my mom really wanted to be Western, and she was always talking about how in Europe, this is chic. In Europe, this is so chic. They're so ahead of the style. This is in mode, all of that stuff. And so the food we ate at home, mostly at my house, was Western food. We ate a lot of steaks and French fries and hamburgers and beef estrogonoff and creme brulee and creme caramel and like beef steak. And then when we moved here, as soon as we moved here, we started eating a lot of Iranian food because, of course, we missed home. And that was the easiest way to feel like a connection to home again.
Wow. Do you remember some of those dishes?
Yeah, she still cooks them. I've been a vegetarian for about 20 years, and I'm a pescatarian now. But so a lot of the food that I'm going to tell you about is food that can be made vegetarian that she makes for me. So I love Zereshk Polo. Zereshk Polo is a rice with these really tart, I think they're called barberries here, really tart berries. And you fry the berries in butter and sugar, and then you sprinkle them over saffron rice and maybe some pistachios and almond slivers.
That sounds amazing.
So incredibly good, yeah. And then we have Adas Polo, which is lentils, adas is lentils, and you do lentils and rice, long grain basmati rice, of course, with a phenomenal tadik. She makes a really great tadik. And you fry raisins and dates in butter, and you... There's a theme here.
Yeah.
You fry something sweet and pour it over rice, and I'll eat it any day.
That sounds really, really good. Did you go out to restaurants at all, when you moved to Washington or when you were in Iran?
Yeah, so not so much in Iran, because I was born right after the revolution and during the Iran-Iraq war, and the country had just changed overnight. Mm-hmm. A lot of restaurants had closed. The quality of food wasn't great. I mean, it was hard to get anything in Iran. My mom was just joking about how she thinks all of our butter came from Chernobyl, right after the revolution. It was really hard to get anything. One of my favorite treats was cornflakes, because you could only find it on the black market sometimes. That was sort of the life we lived. Everything was bought on the black market. It was a very, very hard time for Iranians. And when we moved here, so I think my entire childhood in Iran, the 9 years, I remember going out to 3 restaurants. I'm sure there are some that I've forgotten, but I remember 3 restaurants distinctly, the last being a hamburger place that opened in Tehran down the street from my aunt's apartment. And it was sort of a fast foodie style hamburger place. Mm-hmm. And everyone was so excited, because it was the first, after a long while of war and revolution and all that, it was sort of the first restaurant takeout kind of place that had opened. So I remember that. And then moving here, it was me, my brother, who's 12 years older than me, and my uncle, my mom's brother, who is about 16 years older than me. He and my brother are very close in age and also close to each other. And we all lived together in a suburb of Seattle, and we ate at a lot of fast food restaurants. We loved Burger King. At the time, they had their international chicken sandwiches, and so we would go and buy... you're making a funny face right now,
because I don't remember those sandwiches. No.
This was like very... we were just like, oh, Burger King is so much more posh than McDonald's. And my mom would buy the Italian sandwich, and my uncle always got the French sandwich, and there was an American one, which... then it's not international if you're in America.
Right.
But that was a big thing. We'd go to Pizza Hut a lot. And in my essay, I write about this. It sort of felt like we were a family, because Pizza Hut was a normal family, I should say, because Pizza Hut was dark. And everybody was there with their mom and dad and brother. And although my family was this weird family who was speaking Farsi, which embarrassed the hell out of me, I could pretend I was with my mom and my dad and my brother, even though that wasn't at all kind of the case. So a lot of that. My family discovered, my mom and my brother discovered teriyaki, and I swear I can't even look at teriyaki anymore. They ate so much teriyaki, and not food related. They loved Yanni. We watched, do you know Yanni? He's a new age musician.
No.
We watched so much Yanni.
Matt, the engineer, is looking at me like,
everybody knows Yanni.
Who's Yanni?
Can you talk about Yanni?
I only have sort of vague. Okay, between Noam and I, what do we know about Yanni? He plays a pan flute, and he's got
pan flute
at a very famous live concert at the Acropolis.
Yeah, we watched that about 100 times at my house.
Boom.
And I'm pretty sure I bought his album when I was scamming Columbia Records in the 90s for the season.
That's a throwback. Wow. The mail order, albums, and you never paid them back.
Yep.
That's why they stopped it, because they weren't getting paid.
We all did that.
Yeah, everybody did that. Yep.
Yanni had an amazing mustache and really long hair, and he wore only white, I think. White poofy pants and white shirts, and he was kind of this sex god. And he would throw his head back, and his hair would blow in the wind. You have to please go watch some Yanni
okay,
videos.
Okay, I will
on
Google
YouTube.
Yanni and let you know what I think of this sex god. Yeah, he didn't make it to my household in Maryland. I don't know why.
It's never too late.
That's amazing. So do you have any like current favorite restaurants?
Oh, yeah. I'm obsessed with Sofre. I talk about Sofre all the time. And the chef and founder, Nassim Alikhani, is going to come and speak at Bitten. I didn't know her before Sofre, and I found out this restaurant was opening, and I got so excited because traditionally Iranian restaurants are not great. Like, every Iranian knows that you eat home-cooked food, unless you want chelo kebab, which I don't eat. Chelo kebab restaurants do really, really well. But I went on her website and I was like, God, everything's so beautiful. Everything's so thought out. I can't wait till this restaurant opens. And I walked in and I fell in love with the food. I fell in love with her. I fell in love with her designer. I fell in love with her husband, her brother. Like, I found this other family. So mm-hmm. I love Sofre because it's actually exceptional food. But for me, it feels so much more personal.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And Sofre is in which part of Brooklyn?
It's actually really close to me. I think it's in, technically it's in Prospect Heights. Mm-hmm. It's sort of like near Atlantic Terminal and like Barclays Center. And yeah, it's in Brooklyn. So mm-hmm. it's kind of surprising that it's there, but it's lovely. If you haven't been, good luck getting a reservation.
Right. They just got written up in the New York Times and it was very favorable. So
yeah, yeah.
It's going to be hard to get in there.
Yeah.
Anywhere else?
I love Superiority Burger. I think they're just the perfect little burger. And
I have never been.
What?
I know. It's, yeah. I feel like it's a food writer favorite too, and I've never.
Okay,
been.
We're going.
Okay.
We're going to go
we
for some of that. Yeah.
Solve that.
Yes, that definitely needs to be solved. In my neighborhood, I love Miss Ada. I think it's really phenomenal. And my favorite restaurant that I go to all the time, I actually go there because I like the atmosphere and I know the staff and it feels like my local spot. And it's in Fort Greene. It's called Cafe Paulette. Mm. It's a little French bistro and it feels like a home away from home for me.
Mm. So I ask every guest this without naming names, or you mm-hmm. can name them if you want to. What's one of the worst dining experiences you've ever had?
So I hope I don't give you an unsatisfactory answer, but having a restaurant is so hard and working in a restaurant is so hard that I just don't want to put anyone down for mm. anything that they did that wasn't up to standard or whatever. Everyone has bad days. I don't know. I just think that like it's already such a tough world. Why even make it harder for anyone?
Mm-hmm. That's fair. You don't have to list one. You're the first person to give
oh,
a restaurant.
Really?
Which is funny because last week I got the most like sensational answer to that question. Like, a chef was here and her sister got stabbed in the foot at dinner once and she was like, that is the worst one.
Was it the restaurant staff stabbed
yeah.
on purpose?
No. Oh, okay. they dropped some knives and it went through her foot, which is, you know, not yeah. a good way to end dinner.
No, but things accidents happen,
right?
Yeah.
Okay, so my last question for you, Naz,
mm-hmm.
if you could have your last meal in a restaurant, where would it be, and who is invited?
Okay, it would be at Sofre,
mm-hmm.
Because that's my current favorite. And if does it have to be real people?
No, it can anybody? Be anyone throughout history, people you know, people you don't know.
I mean, there are literally so many people I would want. I love Leonard Cohen. If I could have a meal with Leonard Cohen, I'd be so happy. But if I could have a meal with my mom, dad, and brother, that would be amazing. My brother moved to the States when I was 5, and I don't remember a single meal with the four of us together because then my dad died a few years later. So if by magic that could happen, I think that would be first, and then Leonard Cohen second.
And then he comes in at the end, like, maybe. Okay, so what's what's on the table? Like, what are you eating?
Oh, anything Nassim cooks for us. Vegetarian. I'm going to make everybody eat vegetarian, I think. We're doing our speaker dinner, actually, at Sofre, and you're coming. And Nassim was like, but I want to showcase all of our meat dishes. And I was like, no, I want vegetarian. So, but what she's cooking is going to be amazing. She's going to do, should I tell you what it is?
No, I want to be surprised.
Okay, it's not on the menu though, so it's very exciting.
I'm very excited.
Okay.
What are you drinking?
Oh, I love, it doesn't go with Iranian food at all. I just love a tequila blanco with lime and seltzer water.
Nice.
Soda, as they say.
I mean, it's your last meal. You can have whatever you want.
Whatever I want. That's what I choose for whatever I want. Yeah. I feel like it needs to be cake. I'm just going to have a lot of cake. And that's cake. What.
Have it all. I mean, it's your last meal. Why not have everything?
Yeah.
Excellent. Yeah. Well, thank you so much for being on the show. I'm so excited to speak at Bitten later this month.
Yes.
And thank you so much for listening to A Hungry Society. We will catch you next week.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to hear about exclusive events, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at @heritage_radio. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Rate the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join our community by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.